Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 60, Krishna teases Rukmini, text number 41. Ya danchaya nripa shikam. Ya danchaya nripa shikam ano ni. Try that again. Danchaya nripa shikam anayo nigavanya.
Ya danchaya nripa shikam anayo nigavanya.
Ya danchaya nripa shikam anayo nigavanya. Shikamanyo gavanya. Good luck. Jayanta nahusha gayadaya akyapatyam.
Jayanta nahusha gayadaya akyapatyam.
Rajam rishujya vivishur vanam ambujaksha. Siddhanti te nupadavim ta ihastita kim.
Siddhanti te nupadavim ta ihastita kim.
Ya, out of desire. Nripa, of kings. Shikamanaya, the crown jewels. Angavanya, Jayanta, Nahusha, Gaya Adaya. Anga, the father of Vaina. Vanya, Pritu, the son of Vaina. Jayanta, Bharat. Nahusha, Yayati, Gaya and others. Akya, exclusive. Patyam, having sovereignty. Rajam, their kingdoms. Vrishjaya, abandoning. Vivishu, entered. Vanam, the forest. Ambu Jaksha, O lotus-eyed one. Siddhanti, suffer frustration. Te, your. Anupadavim, on the path. Te, they. Iha, in this world. Astita, fixed. Kim, whither. Translation and purport by Disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Wanting your association, the best kings, Anga, Vanya, Jayanta, Nahusha, Gaya, and others, abandoned their absolute sovereignty and entered the forest to seek you out. How could those kings suffer frustration in this world, O lotus-eyed one? Purport. Here Queen Rukmini refutes the ideas put forward by Lord Krishna in text 13. In fact, Srimati Rukmini Devi repeats Lord Krishna's own words. The Lord said, Astita Padavim Subrihu Praya Siddhanti Yoshita. Women who follow my path generally suffer. Here Rukmini Devi says, Siddhanti Te Nupadavim Ta Ihastita Kim. Why should those fixed on your path suffer in this world? She gives the example of many great kings who renounced their powerful sovereignty to enter the forest, where they performed austerities and worshipped the Lord intensely, desiring his transcendental association. Thus, according to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, Srimati Rukmini Devi here intends to tell Krishna, you have said that I, a king's daughter, am unintelligent and frustrated because I married you. But how can you accuse all these great enlightened kings of being unintelligent? They were the wisest of men, Yet they gave up everything to follow you and were certainly not frustrated by the result. Indeed, they achieved the perfection of your association. Amagana Chamarandasya Janam Janashlakaya Chaksha Umhitanyana Tasma Shri Guru Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Haunting your association, the best of kings, Anga, Vanya, Jayanta, Nahusha, Gaya and others abandoned their absolute sovereignty and they entered the forest to seek you out. How could those kings suffer frustration in this world, O lotus-eyed one? So Rukmini is continuing her very smart countenance to Krishna's reasons for why he was leaving her for, or why she shouldn't have married Krishna for, why he wasn't a suitable husband for her to marry. So this verse is refuting from text 13. So in text 13, obviously Krishna is saying that why did you want to marry me for? Then women who follow me generally end up suffering. So she's counteracting it and saying that, but you know, I'm the daughter of a king, but all these kings, so many kings have actually surrendered to you, have entered the forest and surrendered and rendered service to you. So how can they be unintelligent? They're actually the wisest of people. So it's an interesting point about surrendering to Krishna isn't definitely, like some people might say, Hare Krishna, it's a very sentimental religion. Like if you don't know what Hare Krishna is, and your first impression of devotees might be people walking down the street and banging drums and ringing cowbells and dressed in funny robes and chanting. Externally and superficially, that may look as though it's very, very sentimental. People think, oh, just some sort of religious, fanatical sentimentalists. But of course, we understand that for someone who's surrendered to Krishna's lotus feet and is rendering service to Krishna and is chanting the holy names, then actually they're actually the most intelligent of all people. Obviously, during today's contemporary society, in contrast to Vedic culture, there are so many vast differences. And actually, each culture obviously represented different obstacles in surrendering to Krishna. If we take it from the Vedic context during the Vedic era, then obviously there were also impediments in surrendering to Krishna, becoming his servant, becoming a soul surrendered unto Krishna. So obviously in Vedic times, the culture is somewhat a little bit different to what we have today. During Vedic times, the Vedas obviously have different aspects to them. I mean, there's the Karma Kand section of the Vedas, the Jnana Kand and so forth. In fact, when I was reading this morning how out of all the different verses of the Vedas, there's like 100,000 of them which are talking about the Karma Kand section of the Vedas. So when we refer to Karma Kand, it means the section of the Vedas which promote, you know, economic development, sense enjoyment and religiosity. Generally it's for people who worship demigods. Explains different ritualistic procedures that the Karma Kandi should follow in order to receive material benedictions from the demigods, you know, wealth and fame and good marriage and all these things. No, of course, which is what generally people in the material world are aspiring for. The opulences that can be found by following the Karma Kand section of the Vedas. No, I want money, especially for people in the Grihastha situation, married people. No, they want economic development, want the money, you know, a nice place to live in, a nice car. No, so many things. Needs of the Grihastha. And obviously, all these needs are also present within ancient Vedic culture as well, because these opulences are also present there too. So obviously Krishna refers to these, the Karma Kand section of the Vedas. He says to Arjuna, once your intelligence is cleared of the flowery language of the Vedas, he says the flowery language, because it essentially is promoting heavenly pleasures, you know, a higher standard of sense enjoyment through following the Karma Kand portion of the Vedas. So those who follow the Karma Kand portion of the Vedas are called Karma Kandis, and generally get bewildered. follow demigod worship and ritualistic procedures and so forth so they can enjoy. But in one sense, it's not such a bad thing, because at least by following the Karma Kan portion of Vedas, they're acknowledging higher authority. Just like most people these days follow religiosity, not so much because the desire is to cultivate love of Godhead, but people follow religiosity these days more because they want something. It's a very, in one sense, quite a business-like contractual sort of relationship people want to have with God. I'll worship you, God, because you're my order supplier. If I worship you, then you'll give me this, you'll give me that, and so forth. Like many people come before the deities and aren't necessarily praying to Krishna for pure devotional service and take away my material attachments, but Krishna, I'd like this, I'd like that, please can you arrange this for me, I want this, I want that. So in one sense, it does say in the Vedas that akama asava kamova, moksha kamadarity and so forth, that you have, whether you have no material desires or you have all material desires, you still approach the Lord. Of course, the intent in approaching the Lord should be understood, that the best approach is to not ask Krishna for things, but to ask Krishna to, for service, take away my material attachments, take away my material desires, take away the obstacles which are impeding me becoming closer to you. That's the best way of approaching the Lord. But of course, not everybody does that. But, generally, people practice religion because they see it's a way of attaining something. By being godly, then your level of godliness is manifested by your opulences. Some people think that way. So therefore, that's why you be religious for, because then you can enjoy, you can be materially happy, and you can have nice things. In one sense, it's karma kan mentality, wanting these things. So karma kan is one portion of Vedas which can be bewildering, and is obviously was an obstacle to coming to transcendence. So in Burujan Prabhu's book Surrender Unto Me, he explains that someone who's following the karma kan portion of Vedas, through the association of transcendentalists, they may come to understand that the material realm is actually a place of suffering, it's temporary. Even if you do get your benedictions and your material opulences, they may be taken away. Death will come, so many problems, droughts, famines, problems will come. So even by following the karma kam portion of Vedas, there's still going to be material obstacles and difficulties. Just like in contemporary society, people who may have opulences, wealth and fame and so forth, still miseries are there. Like you look at people who have all these opulences, they're still human beings and they're still struggling, just like everybody else, who don't have those things. They still have difficulties, marriage breakups, relationship problems, drug addictions, depression. No, they still have these problems, they're still there. Whether you have opulences or not, problems will come. You can't avoid these things in the material realm. So by associating with transcendentalists and having transcendental knowledge, you can understand there is a higher goal. There's something beyond just material enjoyment. So this will bring one to the Gana Khan section, or the transcendental section, or following becoming a karma yogi. In other words, becoming a transcendentalist. So it's explained there's two different types of karma yogis. There's the personalists, the Vaishnavas or devotees, and then there's the impersonalists, the Mayavadis or Brahmavadis. Both are transcendentalists, which are following a different understanding. Obviously, the Vaishnavas, the devotees, accept that the form of Lord is personal, that God is a person, whereas the impersonalists say that God is actually isn't personal, it's just Brahman, it's just an energy. So many things to bewilder people on the path of surrendering ultimately to Krishna's lotus feet, which is the goal of the Vedas. Krishna says that of the Vedas I'm to be known, I'm the goal of the Vedas. So during Vedic times, obviously being deviated through impersonalism, which is also present today in contemporary society, that this impersonalism is presented maybe not necessarily as clearly as in the Vedic people who follow the Vedas but accept an impersonalistic understanding. The representation of impersonalism today is more through New Age philosophy. It's very popular these days, New Age kind of pseudo-spiritual philosophy, which ultimately it's just impersonalism, that there is no supreme being. You are the supreme being, or there's the Supreme is just kind of this energy. You know, it's a vague. You can't put a name to it. You can't really describe it. It's just this kind of vague, all-pervasive energy. The energy. So, I mean, this is another obstacle that bewilders people now in contemporary society, just as within Vedic times, and also Mayavad philosophy was present as well, impersonalism was present. Today, also in contemporary society, atheism is obviously very, very rampant, and in fact, atheism is becoming more militant in many, many, many ways. We have great, or so-called great philosophers and scholars who are bewildering people with so many scientific theories and quantum physics theories. What's his name? Stephen Dawkins. He's a well-known physicist who's a very militant atheist, and he's on a whole mission just to totally discredit all religions, totally discredit God. There is no God. Everything can be just reduced to quantum physics, science, atoms, gases, chemicals, and so forth. So this atheism is being propounded, just like we go out in the streets to spread Krishna conscious propaganda, and also atheists are also spreading propaganda as well, and just confusing people, bewildering people, and people have to accept some form of authority. So obviously, if they're reading in newspapers and books these bewildering theories, and being taught these bewildering theories at universities, and they accept those as the authority, and become just bewildered and atheistic and very demoniac in their thinking, in their consciousness. So also during Vedic times, people became another block to coming to Krishna. Another obstacle was obviously through karmakanda and personalism, but also yoga, becoming a mystic yogi, because a mystic yogi wants power, so they can manipulate the material energy, so ultimately they can get some sort of following, adulation from people. They want people to give them some recognition because they have some mystic power. So these mystic powers would bewilder the mystic yogi, and also people who are seeing the person who had the mystic powers would become bewildered. Like we can see even in contemporary times that people who have some sort of mystic power, now there's one particular person who can sometimes apparently manifest gold and rings and jewellery and these sort of things, and his followers say, oh, he is God. Of course, if you question him, he would say, I don't say I'm God. My followers say I'm God. But why do you allow your followers to say such a thing then? If you say you're not God, then why do your followers say it for? So you see that even now in contemporary times, people who may have a bit of mystic power bewilder people into thinking that they're something supreme. So many obstacles there on the path of surrendering to Krishna. So we can see here that Rukmini Devi is glorifying some of the great kings during that era who had actually abandoned their sovereignty and entered into the forest to seek out the Lord, seek out Krishna. So these kings, we can imagine how opulent they would have been during Vedic times. So many wealth was there, they were ruling entire regions of the entire planet. And we see that one person who rules a small country somewhere in Africa becomes completely bewildered by their power. If you've heard of that guy, Idi Amin, he was a ruler in Uganda during the 1970s, and completely demoniac. He was killed, like, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people were killed, and chased many people out of the country just because he wanted to be the absolute ruler of the country with no opposition. So you can see, people who have rule over one small, insignificant portion of land become bewildered by their power. The opulences that come along with it, and the adulation and respect and so forth that come along with it. So what to speak of these kings during the Vedic times, it would have been very bewildering, having rule of the entire planet, so much wealth at your disposal, so many followers, opulent palaces, so many different wives, so many different things. You can imagine, you become bewildered. So Rukmini is glorifying these kings as being the most intelligent and enlightened because they surrendered to Krishna. They actually renounced all of these opulences, renounced their attachment, and went to the forest to find Krishna. Very, very difficult to do. We see even in the Mahabharata that Dhritarashtra, after the war had taken place, he was living in the house of the Pandavas, and they were serving him very nicely and looking after him, and he was enjoying this life, even though that he had caused the war in one sense. It was his fault the war had taken place because of his attachment to Duryodhana and his sons. He had caused the war. But the Pandavas, out of their mercy, were allowing Dhritarashtra to reside within their kingdom. So Dhritarashtra was attached, very good example of someone who's very, very attached. So attached to maintaining power, so attached to his offspring being the rulers. So it wasn't until Dhritarashtra actually had the association of Vidura, who came and preached to him, saying, "Look, you're living like a dog in the house of the Pandavas. You know, you're old, your teeth are falling out, you know, your liver's packing in. What are you doing? You know, go to the forest. It's time to renounce, give up these attachments, you know, become self-realized." So through the association of Vidura, Dhritarashtra was able to give up his attachments and realize, "Oh, what am I doing?" Because the effect of passing of time, we're not conscious of it. Time is also one of Krishna's energies, but we're not conscious of it, how it's actually affecting us, making us age. And over time, obviously, if we don't become purified of our attachments, they don't go away. Unless we follow a system of purification, the attachments remain within the heart. So to become detached, obviously, it comes through the association of devotees. So many of these great kings, Anga, Vanya, Janta, when they go to the forest, it means they're seeking out self-realization, seeking out the association of self-realized souls. Just like we read, obviously, the story in the Srimad Bhagavatam of Maharaj Parikshit, a very famous example. Maharaj Parikshit, another king who obviously knew his death was coming, through the snake bird who was going to come and bite him and kill him. He knew he only had a week left to live. So, obviously, being having the association, the opportunity to associate with transcendentalists, he knew that actually now it's time to become detached. It's time to leave these things, go to the forest and focus my consciousness on Krishna. So set a very good example for people to follow, that when death is coming, then the best thing to do is to give up your attachments. But we can see usually in materialistic culture, what is it when people do? Like, if you ask people, if you knew you had a week left to live, or a month left to live, or 6 months left to live, what would you do? What sort of responses do you think people would give if they don't have transcendental knowledge? Yeah, enjoyment. Oh, I'd live life to the max. I'd surround myself with my family and friends. I'd go to Disneyland. No, so many things that I do. Yeah.
Apparently, a little while ago in the US, there was a show where they were showing a person who had cancer was destined to die in 1 year, and they're showing how he was enjoying some gratification. Some people were really addicted to that program.
Mm.
Like the Ram Dass show.
Mm. Yeah, it's a result of, it's ignorance actually, a result of not having transcendental knowledge. That's all people know. All they know is just the body and senses and sense gratification. So if death is coming, then I better intensify my sense gratification. So this sort of culture and civilization that is completely condemned by the Vedic culture. The Shastra completely condemns that way of thinking. Completely condemns it. So that's why Rukmini is glorifying these kings. Like, if for a materialist to hear that someone was a ruler of the earth, they had wealth, they had opulences, they had money, they'd be thinking, oh well, they have so much facility for enjoying and having a good time, and they give it up. What's wrong with these people? So you see, it's different ways of thinking, different consciousness. So in the Vedic culture, we glorify those sort of people who do that, who give these things up. They'll be glorified because they understand there's a higher purpose to life. So Maharaj Parikshit, obviously, a very good example of surrendering all his wealth and opulence, goes to the forest and surrenders to Shukadeva Goswami, except Shukadeva Goswami is a spiritual master, and through his association of Shukadeva Goswami, who's a pure devotee, he was able to lift Maharaj Parikshit's consciousness up to the transcendental platform, to the highest realms of transcendence, which is obviously Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. So very, very fortunate. So this is in one sense what the Krishna consciousness movement is about, is to spread this knowledge, give people the opportunity to have association with transcendentalists. That's one of the goals that Prabhupada set ISKCON up for, is to create facility so people would hear about the pastimes of Krishna. because it's only through hearing about topics of Krishna, Krishna Katha, that one can become give up their attachment to the material world through hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, associating with devotees and so forth. These things will help people overcome their attachments to matter. So that's the process of Krishna consciousness. So Rukmini is glorifying these great kings who have done such a thing, gone to the forest. So that's what Vedic civilization is about, is teaching people how to go to the forest. So for devotees, which forest do the devotees go to? Yeah, we go to Vrindavan forest. Yeah, that's the forest at the Banam that we focus on, is Vrindavan forest, or Mayapur Dham, or Jagannath Puri Dham. These are the places that the devotees go. You see, when devotees in ISKCON are passing away, then generally they want to go to Vrindavan or go to the holy places so they can absorb their consciousness and thought of Krishna. As Krishna says that, yam yam bhavi smaram bhavam tajanti kalibram, that whatever your remembrance is, your smaram bhavanam, your thoughts at death, then that is the destination that you will attain. So for devotees, we understand we want our consciousness to be as absorbed in Krishna as possible. So at the time of death, we're going to be thinking of Krishna. We can, as we were talking about Bhakti Teda Swami yesterday, if we read some of his final pastimes in this realm, he went into Nijan Bhajan. Within the last month or so, whatever it was, last few weeks of his physical association with us, he decided he didn't want to, in one sense, become completely disentangled from worldly affairs. Like, he wasn't going to answer emails anymore. He limited the people that were coming to visit him, and people who were in his association, it had to be strictly Krishna Katha. So you can see, just like you can say in one sense, Maharaj Parikshit had Tripadeva Goswami, then who did Bhakti Teda Swami have with him the whole time leading up to his passing? Radhana Swami, yeah. They're very, very intimate friends. So the whole lead up to Bhakti Teda Swami leaving his body, Radhana Swami was with him the whole time. And if you read some of the intimate dealings that Radhana Swami had with Bhakti Teda Swami, very, very, very sweet. Now, Radhana Swami would be reading Chaitanya Charitamrita to him. Other devotees would be having 24-hour kirtans in the room outside where he was staying. So very, very intimate, very, very transcendental atmosphere was created through the association of devotees. So Bhakti Teda Swami didn't actually go to Vrindavan. He chose not to leave this world in one of the holy dharms. He actually left his body in Gita Nagari. He was setting the example that these theatres that Prabhupada has created around the world, they are non-different from the holy dharms in India. Like Prabhupada says, if we go out to the courtyard out there, there's that nice quote on the notice board. Prabhupada says that, don't think this is Melbourne, but this is Vrindavan. This is Vrindavan, this is not Melbourne. This is the spiritual world. So Bhakti Teda Swami was setting that example for us, that actually we are in the spiritual realm by rendering service in one of the Tedas Prabhupada has created around the world. So we're very, very fortunate that we have the opportunity to reside in a holy Teda and associate with devotees and render service in a holy Teda. Very fortunate. So obviously we're doing these things so our consciousness can become absorbed in Krishna. That's the purpose of coming to a temple, is so we can absorb ourselves in Krishna by rendering service, hearing the holy name, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, associating with devotees. So this is the point of coming to a temple, not just to come to a temple just to ask for some sort of material gain or some material wealth or some material opulence. The real purpose is to engage the consciousness in Krishna in some way. So this is what Rukmini is glorifying these kings for doing such a thing, absorbing their consciousness in Krishna. So, as we're talking about, many different obstacles there to stop people surrendering to Krishna's lotus feet. Many, many obstacles, not just within Vedic times, but also in contemporary times. In one sense, obviously in contemporary culture, there are more obstacles now to surrendering to Krishna. So many, many obstacles. Kali Yuga is becoming, as it progresses, becomes more and more difficult to practice self-realization. There are so many more facilities here for sense enjoyment. People now, especially in Western cultures, there's more money, there's more disposable income. So people take their wages to engage in more and more vices, more and more sinful activity. More wealth, as in there's more sinful activity there. You know, more casinos, more intoxication. You know, illicit sex has been promoted, like pornography now is becoming more and more prominent. You know? And unfortunately, because of with the internet, it's people are given access to pornography and so forth at a very young age. Like people, 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old, have access to all these horrible illicit things through the internet. So the consciousness from a very, very young age is being pulled down to a very low level. Maya is very, very, very powerful. And you can see now that people from a young age are getting involved in sense gratification from as younger age as possible, and they're being actually encouraged to do that from a very young age. You can see the media encourages these things. The movies that people are seeing, the books people are reading, encourage people to engage in illicit, lusty affairs. So when the consciousness is absorbed in that, it's very, in such strong bodily consciousness, it's very, very hard to break out of that way of thinking. Very, very difficult, because obviously sex life is one of the highest pleasures that one can experience in the material world. So when one's consciousness is just absorbed in that, the body becomes very, very gross, very, very lusty. You can see people whose consciousness is absorbed in that, the way they present themselves, very degraded, the way they present themselves and interact with people, very, very, very base. So very difficult to practice spiritual life when the consciousness is absorbed in that. And obviously meat eating, very prominent now within Kali Yuga. People think it's normal to eat meat. In fact, people think to be vegetarian or have a non-meat diet, they think it's strange or you're lacking something. And people say, you must be iron deficient, or you must be lacking something for not eating meat. But this is just because of the propaganda that's been put out. It's all propaganda. I've been vegetarian for over 10 years now, and I'm fine. Whenever I've had a blood test done or anything done, I've never been told that you're deficient in any minerals or vitamins at all. My wife had a blood test done recently, and the results came back and she's fine. There's no problem at all. So how can it be then, if we're vegetarian, that we're lacking anything? So it's just all propaganda. It's all propaganda, that's all. So many obstacles there on the path of surrendering and approaching to Krishna. And of course, in Western civilization, there's no spiritual culture at all, really. In India, at least, there's still some remnants of Vedic civilization left over, but in Western culture, there's nothing at all. Nothing at all. People are completely ignorant. No idea of what the goal of life is, no idea of the difference between matter and spirit, and most people don't even think there is a supreme being. So many, many obstacles. So it's a great challenge to present Krishna consciousness, to take people from their current level of mindset they're in and bring them to a higher level. But this is a mission that Lord Chaitanya has empowered ISKCON to do, is to take people's consciousness from the lowest up to the highest thing. So it is a great challenge to do these things. But obviously by people who do that, who accept that as a mission, there is great mercy available. And this is how we make advancement in Krishna consciousness, especially in Kali Yuga, is through the mercy that is coming through the parampara. And the parampara, obviously, the emphasis is on personal transformation, becoming Krishna conscious yourself, but also distributing that and sharing that with other people. That is the mood that the parampara is giving us. So there's great mercy descending for those who do that. And that is the Vaishnava way of doing things. As we talked about, yogis and jnanis and so forth, their whole endeavour is to, through their own efforts, that they will become self-realised, they'll become transcendental through their own effort. But a devotee doesn't think that way. A devotee becomes dependent on the Lord and the Lord's mercy. That's what a devotee is praying for. A devotee is praying for Krishna's mercy. Please, Krishna, give me your mercy. Not that we necessarily expect Krishna to give us his mercy. Not that, I've been rendering service to you for so many years, or I've been in the ashram now for 2 months, and you should be giving me this and giving me that. You should be manifesting yourself to me, Krishna. I've been in the ashram for 2 months. I've been chanting Hare Krishna now for one whole year, 16 rounds every day. Why aren't you revealing yourself to me? So the devotee doesn't expect Krishna to reveal himself to us, but we do depend on Krishna's mercy. We become dependent on Krishna's mercy, and it's a symptom of advancement by becoming dependent on Krishna. Krishna, I'm having this difficulty, but I know through your mercy you will help me through this. Please help me through this challenge or this obstacle, or please help me make more advancement in my faith, and so forth. So that's the mood, becoming dependent on Krishna's mercy. And Krishna will give it. It's not that Krishna's going to ignore our prayers. No, Krishna hears our prayers for mercy and advancement, and he'll reciprocate with that when he sees our sincerity of heart. That's the main thing. Just become a sincere devotee. And try and get rid of all other motivations and so forth, and just be a sincere devotee. Be a sincere servant of Prabhupada's mission and Prabhupada's servants. And Krishna will definitely give you his mercy, no doubt about that. Because we can see so many nice examples of devotees in the movement who have sincerely surrendered their life to Prabhupada's mission and have got huge mercy. Obviously, Bhakti Teta Swami, we've been talking about him. A very great example of someone who surrendered their entire life, completely sold out to Prabhupada's mission, and got such great mercy coming through the Parampara, through preaching in the Iron Curtain, his other spread Krishna consciousness there. In America, had a big impact on especially the Afro-American people in America, had great influence over them. He was able to influence world leaders. Obviously, he was very close with Nelson Mandela, Muhammad Ali, a great boxer. Bhakti Teta Swami is one of his close advisors and associates at one time period. So you can see that he was able to do these things through the mercy, because he sold out to Prabhupada's mission. So that's the secret to making advancement, is we know how to get the mercy. Look for places to get the mercy, and the mercy will come, especially through the Parampara. So this is how a devotee approaches Krishna, not through our own strength or our own endeavour. Just to see how austere I am, how little I'm eating, how many austerities I'm performing, I take cold baths every day. This isn't necessarily going to, that may help you control your senses, but it doesn't necessarily mean Krishna is going to give you his mercy. So we just have to be a bit intelligent about how to receive the mercy properly, because so much mercy is there. So different obstacles which to be overcome on the path of devotion. And it's only through rendering service to Krishna that we can actually become free from the material world. Like Krishna says, Bahunam janmanamante, ganamam pravajante, vasudeva samamiti, samahatma sadulabha. That actually after many, many, many births, a person who understands me, vasudeva samamiti, that I'm the cause of all causes, that I'm the supreme being, Vasudeva Samamiti will surrender unto me. I knew understood this after many, many births, but such a soul is very rare. Samahatma Sadulabha. A great soul is actually very, very rare, who understands Krishna's position properly. And Krishna also says that, and many, many people who are trying to strive for perfection, only a few may actually know him in truth. So, not necessarily that easy to approach Krishna. So, also in Vedic times, those difficulties and obstacles are there to approach Krishna as well. So it's through the association of the Vaishnavas that one can attain a high level of consciousness, can go beyond just karmakand, religiosity, sense gratification and so forth, through the association of devotees. So that mercy is available. And through the association of devotees, what happens when one associates with devotees? What will happen when one associates with devotees? Through Sadhu Sangha, what happens? Yeah, what does it mean to be Krishna conscious? Yeah, yeah. Well, what does it mean to be Krishna conscious? What does it mean you do?
You get to learn from service.
Yeah, you engage in service. You engage in service. Yeah. But what's the definition of bhakti?
Our consciousness becomes pure.
Uh-huh. How do our acharyas define bhakti yoga? Yeah, devotional service. Yeah, the path of devotional service. Yeah, devotional service. Yeah. So in other words, it's not just an awe and reverence and yes, I love you so much and God, yes, you're great. Yeah, it means actually doing something practical, devotional service. So when we associate with devotees will engage us in devotional service. So it's through devotional service, and in the Nectar of Devotions it's explained, Savo Pari Vinaya Muktam Tat Paritva Nimalam Hishri Kena Hishikesha Sevanam Bhakta Uchite. That actually through rendering devotional service, engaging in practical devotional service, has two side effects. You get free of your upadis, your material designations, and your senses become purified. So this is what happens when you engage in devotional service. your attachment to the bodily and bodily conception of life will minimise, and your senses will become purified as well. So purified senses means that you're engaging them solely in Krishna's service. So this is how we transcend the material energy, is through devotional service. Sarvapari Vinirmuktam. So this is what the Vedic culture is gearing people towards. So I've explained the different steps in the yoga ladder, going through Karma Khan, through to Karma Yogi, through to Sakam Karma Yoga, when you engage in devotional service with material desires, to Nishkam Karma Yoga, when you engage in devotional service free of all material desires, right up to Krishna Prema. So this is what the whole Vedic culture is about, is elevating people through the lowest consciousness up to the highest, Krishna Prema, through the different processes or systems this way. So just in Vedic times, the system was there, and in Kali Yuga, the system was also available as well. So it wasn't just in Vedic times difficulties were there, but also difficulties are present now as well in Kali Yuga. But of course, the difficulties that maybe they had to experience to become self-realized have been minimized to some degree in Kali Yuga through the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. Like Kali, Kali, Nana, Rupa, Krishna, Evita. That in the sage of Kali, Krishna has made himself available through his holy name. Lord Chaitanya says that Krishna has invested all of his transcendental energies within his holy name. So the process of self-realization has become made a lot easier now in Kali Yuga. So some of the difficulties that these guys had to go through, like these kings had to go to the forest, but Prabhupada never taught us to go to the forest, live in a forest, you know, wear bark, you know, sit down and meditate. And we don't have to do these things, we just have to chant the holy name. So the process is actually made a lot easier for us, a lot easier in Kali Yuga. So in one sense we're very fortunate. I think it's even explained that the demigods are wanting to take birth in Kali Yuga because the process of Yuga Dharma for self-realization is so easy in Kali Yuga through the holy name. You don't have to do great austerities, don't have to practice asanas, don't have to, you know, like sit down and try and control the mind through breathing processes and so forth. Simply through chanting the holy name, the process is made easy for us. So, very fortunate position to be in. So we'll stop there and ask if there's any questions or points at all from what we've been talking about. Well, Prabhupada, when he was present, did encourage his devotees to go to India, and he'd encourage them to go once every year or once every 2 years, whatever it may be, he encouraged devotees to do. I mean, obviously, because Krishna is more present in his holy tethers, just like Krishna is present present in his deity form, and obviously Krishna is present maybe in one sense in his own abode of Vrindavan Dham and Mayapur Dham. He's more manifest there. So when we go to these holy places, Krishna is more and more present there, so we can become more engaged in consciousness because the whole atmosphere is surcharged with Krishna consciousness. I don't know, Keshav, what would you say? Krishna is more present in his holy dharms, and everyone there is a devotee. In the West, when we walk out the front gate, we're kind of going from one sense, going from the light into the darkness, whereas when you go to the holy dharms, everyone there is a devotee. Krishna consciousness is all pervasive, so it's a lot easier to remember Krishna and think of Krishna, engage in service, whereas in Western countries, you know, the temple is definitely an oasis, but when you're outside the temple environment, the modes are very strong. You know, sinful activity is more prominent, Kali Yuga is more prominent, whereas in the holy places it's a very, very transcendental atmosphere. Everyone's a devotee. It's easy to remember Krishna when everyone else is thinking of Krishna. Zintra?
Yeah.
Stephen Dawkins?
Yes.
Stephen or Richard?
No, Stephen Dawkins, the one who helped with an atheist.
Yeah.
And one of his early theories was very interesting, the resonance field of metamorphic resonance. And he had found that in temples, the resonance was very different because they had developed a metamorphic field according to the activities that one would find in cinemas, you know, and other locations. So in that sense, even though he may be an atheist, he has, you know, some similarities, you know, that Prabhupada said, holy dance.
Any other points or questions at all? Kondra Shima Bhagavatam Ki Jai.